Hello and welcome to another episode of the Leaders Sport Business Podcast, the podcast about leaders in sport from leaders in sport. My name is James Emmett. I'm the editorial director here at Leaders. We should just record that, shouldn't we? I say literally the same thing every week. David Cushman, content director. Hello.
Hello. Yes. No, it's good though. It's good practice.
Yeah, it is good practice. Yeah. It's nice to be able to say something on autopilot, isn't it?
Yes. Could you do it again?
I don't think so. I think I've only got one in me a day. David, how are you? How are you doing?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. Yeah. Busy, but we're all busy, aren't we? We're all busy. Yeah. And do you know what? The sport keeps on coming, doesn't it?
It does. What have we been watching recently? I've been watching a bit of NBA playoffs, actually.
Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're in the thick of the playoffs.
Yeah, they're good.
I've been watching a little bit of the World Snooker Championship.
Yes.
Back on.
I watched Ronnie O'Sullivan's Perfect Break the other day. And it's from 1990...
Something,
when Embassy sponsored the World Championships. Yes. And what struck me was the pace. The pace of it. He's absolutely running around the table. Incredible.
Yep. Would it be nice if he'd had a golden ball to pot at the end, wouldn't it?
But a dream at that point. Yeah.
I've also been watching, and I am really enjoying it, some of the tennis from Madrid. It's the ATP and WTA 1000 event in the Caja Mágica.
Yeah, can I say, actually, an apology?
A correction.
Yeah, correction, because we mentioned that a few weeks ago when we were talking about the shenanigans going on behind the scenes in tennis. Essentially, there are these two proposals for the future of tennis that are being discussed in Madrid, behind the scenes at the Madrid Open. And a few weeks ago when we discussed it, talked about the Madrid Open being owned by the colourful character that is Jon Tiriac. Not anymore.
No.
He sold it to IMG a couple of years ago.
He did, although after that, and I think we have to call it a mistake, James, from you on the podcast a couple of weeks back, I did notice that Mr. Tiriac is promoting a tennis tournament back in his homeland of Romania.
Is he really?
Yes, I think it's a 250, so great. A smaller tournament.
Good. Tobacco Baron, Jon Tiriac.
Yeah.
Okay, is it good? Madrid Open?
It is good, actually. It's a big old venue, and it only seems to be really full when either Carlos Alcaraz or Rafael Nadal is in action. I think there's a bit of... there's been a bit of a change recently in terms of the structure of those 1,000 tournaments. They've gone from 1 week, which was all action all the time, probably too much action, to a really more leisurely 2 week tournament.
It's not enough.
Which is not enough. So there's probably a happy medium to be found. Yeah. But we're in the clay court swing, which is always a great time of year.
Poor Rafael Nadal. I've been noticing a lot of Nadal versus Alcaraz content. And Nadal does not come off that well in terms of how old he looks these days. He really, this year, I think Rafael Nadal looks every one of his... How old is he? 52 now? Poor bloke. It's the thinning hair, I think.
Yeah, I think really so. Age catches up.
Have you seen any of the LIV Golf this week, David? They've been in Australia. They've been in Adelaide.
Didn't catch it live. Difficult time zone for UK viewers.
I don't know whether this is because of some sort of subset of who I follow on social media, but I feel like this particular tournament I've seen more of across various social media platforms than I have any other LIV tournament. And it's interesting. I haven't watched any of the action live. I've just seen the hype, the PR, the people, like the ground absolutely heaving. The various other kind of corollary events that go on. And actually, I saw Will Steger, who runs media and media production for LIV Golf, talk about this as LIV Golf's Super Bowl. And I thought that was interesting pretty hackneyed shorthand that people in the sports industry use. But clearly some promotional effort has gone into that tournament. I'm not sure it can be a Super Bowl unless it is the culmination of a season and it is the most important game from a sporting point of view as well. I'm not sure this is the most important sporting tournament on the LIV Golf calendar.
No, it's a popular tournament. It got a lot of headlines last year because of the audience. Big crowds attending in Adelaide.
Is this the waste management equivalent?
Well, they have created this, what they call the watering hole, which is a stadium-like waste management open-like hole with the accompanying atmosphere. But it's also, I think, a reflection of the fact that until last year when LIV Golf came back, it's been actually quite a long time since so many top golfers have played in a tournament in Australia. So there's been a scarcity factor there that I think has played into it. But fair play, again, big crowds this year in Adelaide. And it's interesting how much of the Adelaide tournament from last year has made it into the promotional stuff that LIV is doing this year. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that will continue.
Yeah. What else has been going on this week, Dave? Have you booked on some more speakers, I see, for our upcoming Razzmatazz in New York, Force?
Yeah, we're not far away now. Yeah. Later this month, we can say. Force New York, 21st and 22nd of May, part of a big sports industry week in New York.
Yes, I saw on the, you announced a few speakers on our internal, on our team's channel.
Yeah, managed to tag you in that.
You found the chaps emoji. How did you, what was that in aid of?
You're going to have to fill me in. Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I don't use emojis on the, you know, the company internet.
You do.
Other than the thumbs up and occasionally the laugh emoji.
All right.
We have booked some cowboys. Literally, we're working with the team over at Professional Bull Riders on a session, which I think is going to be a lot of fun and really insightful. It will focus on how you super serve a specific pocket of fans, a specific subculture, if you like. And we're going to explore those themes through the lens of cowboy culture, Western culture. We're going to do so with the chief marketing officer of the Professional Bull Riders, which is this, you know, this competition that's on an extraordinary growth path in the US and filling arenas, subject of a fantastic documentary that I'm sure I've mentioned before called The Ride on Prime Video, the behind the scenes of the tour. Genuinely one of the best sports docs in that genre that I've seen. But we've also got an ex-bull rider on the program as well, Colby Yates. And he's particularly interesting because he's now the head coach of one of the teams in the PBR. But he was a bull rider, and at the same time, he was a burgeoning country music artist, and he still is recording and playing music. And so we're going to hear from him, hopefully in more ways than one. But I think he's going to have a really fascinating perspective because he's extremely passionate about cowboy culture, protecting cowboy culture, but also then how that plays out and how brands can effectively leverage that to connect with fans and new fans.
It's unexpected, at least for me, but cowboy culture is really having a moment right now.
Beyonce
has obviously released a what is being billed as a country album. The music culture has always been huge, but now I think is reaching more and more more people than ever. There's a bit of a moment in fashion as well. Louis Vuitton's gone big on cowboy themed is it clothes they're into? Yep. There are more and more events springing up which sort of hark towards cowboy culture. I think there's, bizarrely, I saw this big thing about cowboy culture is a huge thing in the LGBT plus community over in the US at least, and it's kind of sweeping New York especially.
And I think there's also a little bit of the Taylor Swift phenomenon there in terms of where she's come from.
There's a little bit of that. What's the cowboy film? Heath Ledger and
Brokeback Mountain.
Yes, I think that's the genesis for quite a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll be there. You'll be in your Stetson. I'll be in my chaps, the aforementioned chaps.
Yeah.
And we're going to be tapping into this particular culture at Force.
Yes, it's going to be a lot of fun. I think
it is.
Hidden gem of a session.
Yeah. I had a coffee last week with a very prominent sports news reporter, David. There's a bit of a bonfire of the journos going on over here in the UK. Well, Henry Winter, obviously one of the most prominent sports well, football. Is he a reporter? Is he a commentator?
Yeah. No, yeah, football reporter. The chief football correspondent at the Times newspaper until a couple of weeks ago.
It was made redundant, and there is now a wave of redundancies in the sports section of the Daily Mail, which I think is the is one of the most popular newspapers over here in the UK. I think COVID and the ramifications of COVID catching up with the sports media, sports journalism sector at the moment in the UK, and it's raising or sort of underlining and bolding questions about the model for covering sports over here in the UK. Also questions about these sort of this generation of journalists, probably a little bit older than us, well, definitely older than us, probably paid in a way that journalists wouldn't be paid now. What do they do now? All this wave of people who have been lauded and esteemed and paid relatively well for what they've done, now without a place to go at sort of mid-40s, early 50s. Do they take our jobs, Dave?
Well, perhaps. Definitely a challenging moment for journalism in general. And I think if they have been smart, many of them have very large...
Pension? Many of them... financial planning.
No, I'm not. Many of them have very large social followings and have established themselves. I mean, Henry Winter, I think the most followed football journalist, probably millions of followers, I would imagine, literally. And so you can build something off the back of that in terms of doing your own thing, or a lot of people are starting their own newsletters. We've seen this a little bit in the US sports media. I think there was a big moment a few years ago where, and it's also about the nature of what is of value and goes into a newspaper. The traditional match report, you know, chronicling what happened when, has a less value in an age where everybody has access to all information at all times. And I think the New York Times made a move away from match reports and reporting on games in the traditional fashion a number of years ago. So that changes the look and feel of the New York Times sports department and the sports section.
And actually the New York Times, it's still absolutely the model that more traditional media companies are looking to emulate. They just recently, in the last couple of months, went through the $1 billion mark in terms of subscriptions. They are, when it comes to sport, they do have a sports section. They do have sports reporters focused over here in the UK, at least, in sports news. But they also own The Athletic, and it's almost the petri dish for how to make considered shoulder content, journalistic shoulder content for sport, pay.
Yeah, absolutely. And so obviously solidarity with anybody who's recently lost their jobs in that sector, because it's tricky times, definitely. And it's worth saying it's not just sports journalism, it's journalism across the board is obviously facing a tricky moment. And yeah, the question of where they all go is really interesting. There are multiple, I mean, we've also sort of in chime with these changes, we've seen the rise of very popular, substantial YouTube first, a new wave of football, would you call them journalists, broadcasters, commentators, voices, mouths? But they are very popular and they have large audiences and they have the ability to deliver instant reaction, live reaction, in a way that a newspaper journalist is simply not able to now.
Yeah. It is interesting how I think we're all now established in our kind of sports consumption patterns, you know, with our kind of primary sports passion. So I am an Arsenal supporter and I watch as many games as I can, either live or through legitimately purchased subscriptions.
Very good.
And then I used to read as many match reports as I could. I don't any longer. I read two specific blogs and listen to two specific podcasts. That's basically fan-owned media, and that is my bread and butter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think podcasts are a big element of this, and certainly as in my own experience, as you know, time available to sit down and watch lots of live sport diminishes, podcasts, because they are available on the move, very handy way of doing that. And I would say there's a couple of sports that I follow almost and I'm interested in, but I follow almost exclusively via a really good podcast.
Tennis
on that
is
topic.
One, isn't it?
Tennis is definitely one.
I follow cycling exclusively via podcast as well.
And it sort of does the job.
Sort of. It's a way to get the analysis, but strip the passion out of the thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, should we do some news?
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Why don't you turn this way, I'll turn that way, and together we've got the full 360 covered. This is 180 seconds of Sports Biz.
FIFA has, after much speculation, confirmed Saudi oil giant Aramco as a major worldwide partner for the next 4 years. That includes the next men's and women's World Cups in 2026 and 2027. Aramco's global sponsorship portfolio already includes F1, the Aston Martin F1 team, and the International Cricket Council. Saudi Arabia is the only bidder for the 2034 men's FIFA World Cup.
Meanwhile, the USA and Mexico have withdrawn their joint bid to host the 2027 Women's World Cup and will instead bid for the 2031 tournament. The decision means a joint bid from Belgium and Germany or the Netherlands will host in 2027, with FIFA due to vote later this month.
Amazon Prime Video and the NBA reportedly have a framework agreement in place for a major package of rights. The Athletic first reported the agreement, which would begin in the 2025-26 season and could run for as long as 10 years, including regular season, postseason, and potentially conference finals games in the US, as well as some global rights. Incumbent NBA broadcast partners ESPN and ABC are believed to have similar framework deals in place on revised terms. TNT and NBC are also in the frame for other rights packages as the NBA sets out its expansive next broadcast rights model.
Four-time WNBA champion Sue Bird has joined the ownership group of Seattle Storm, the team she played her whole career for. The size of the investment and stake was not revealed. Bird will be joining us in New York later this month as a speaker at Force New York.
The Ferrari Formula One team has secured a new title partner in Hewlett-Packard. The deal, brokered by Omnicom-owned Fuse Ignite, is reported to be worth as much as $300 million over 5 years, comparable to Red Bull Racing's deal with Oracle. HP logos will be on the Ferraris from this weekend's Miami Grand Prix, ahead of Lewis Hamilton's arrival at the team in 2025.
DAZN has threatened the German Football League, DFL, with legal action, claiming the league's domestic deal with Sky for the 2025-26 to 2028-29 seasons is unlawful. DAZN claims its own bid for the bulk of the rights in the next cycle was higher than Sky's. The rights process has been halted as a result, but the DFL called DAZN's claims inaccurate. DAZN and Sky currently share rights to the Bundesliga in Germany, with Sky broadcasting the bulk of live games.
And George Pine's Bruin Capital has acquired a majority stake in turf management firm Playgreen. The deal values Playgreen, which counts the likes of Wimbledon, Arsenal, FC Barcelona and the Dallas Cowboys as clients, at some $120 million. And that was 180 seconds of Sports Biz.
This is the Leaders Sport Business podcast with James Emmett and David Cushman. No guest today, James, so it gives us an opportunity to reflect a little on some of those stories and some other bits and pieces that we're looking at.
I love the turf deal, David. You know, we see
big turf deal.
Great. I love it when there is a $100 million turf deal. Like, honestly, that excites me in such a kind of agricultural way.
Very nice.
No, because we receive lots of press releases, lots of people PRing their news. We hear about glamorous investments and acquisitions and all sorts of stuff in the sports industry. A lot of them technology focused. Even if they're not technology focused, they are positioned as kind of future innovation. There's going to be a tech element. Oh, there's AI involved somewhere. Of course there is. But I love this. It's back to basics. There is money in the nuts and bolts, the fabric of how sport works. And George Pine and Bruin have got a fantastic track record of late of investing not insignificant sums into businesses, growing them, doing whatever they do in terms of the internal operations, of those businesses and getting serious multiples on their return, sometimes within as little as 5 years. And I wonder, with a turf company, you know, what X is George Pine looking for here?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
Will seed capital be involved?
Good, I knew that was going to be something.
But maybe we are underselling.
Oh, is there AI actually involved here?
I would suspect that if you ask the team at Playgreen, they would probably call themselves less a turf company.
More a technology company.
More a technology company. Because there's a heck of a lot of technology involved. If you think about the...
Well, you're either a tech business or you're a community business,
aren't
you?
That's it.
And it's turf, so it's tech, right?
Turf is tech, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, surf and turf. Great. We don't have a guest, but we've got a new sort of feature in the podcast, David.
Yes.
We're going to do something called Inside the Deal.
Okay.
Not today, but maybe at some point in the future we might get some jazzy music for it.
Yep.
But now...
Or not.
Inside the Deal. Maybe the sound of sort of a cash register. I don't know.
Well, a couple of big deals this week.
Huge deals.
FIFA and Aramco was confirmed, which has been speculated about for many months.
Been in the works for a while,
Sort of makes sense if you join up the dots and think about where the World Cup is heading, the Men's World Cup in 2034. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting timing, and this has not been reported, so I'm absolutely...
This is not our new feature, by the way.
No,
this
I know.
Is just
this is a
extra stuff on another deal.
I just wanted to say... There is no link on the surface between the USA and Mexico withdrawing their bid to host the 2027 Women's World Cup and FIFA doing a deal with Aramco that runs through that tournament in 2027. But I do wonder, wild speculation, whether there is something in that, and actually the US and Mexico have decided to push back their own bid, partly for that reason. Another element will, of course, be they didn't probably want to go commercially head-to-head with the LA 2028 Olympics. But an interesting story there in terms of FIFA and working out what its next decade looks like and how the obvious Saudi involvement at a sponsorship level, at a tournament hosting level, perhaps has impacts elsewhere.
Yeah. It's also looking at the commercial side of things. It perhaps enlarges the window for soccer sponsorship deals, soccer partnerships that are going to take place in North America, the Men's World Cup obviously coming up there in 2026. If you go 5 years later as opposed to 1 year later, you're able to sign significantly larger deals, I would say. You're able to expand that marketing window as long as they are committed to doing it. I think it's probably a sensible decision even.
Indeed. Now we have a new feature.
Oh yeah, what's it about? So it's called Inside the Deal, and the aim is to take you inside a deal, a particularly prominent deal that's happened over the last 7 days or so. The Hewlett-Packard one, HP and Ferrari is the one that we're going to go for this week. Mentioned in dispatches last week. It had been in the pipeline, confirmed late last week, wasn't it?
Yes, and we should say kudos to the team at Sport Business who had the exclusive on
did
this
they
one.
Really?
Had the jump on this one. Excellent bit of reporting.
Can I just say that Sport Business have come up with a few firsts of late, good for them, and I hope it's doing their numbers a whole lot of good. But I do find, so they had this this HP and Ferrari one, as you mentioned, David, but they also had Liverpool switching kit manufacturers to Adidas.
Which hasn't been confirmed yet.
It
but
hasn't
it's
been
in
confirmed yet. But I do wonder about, and this was builders, a load of people text me about this, like John Rest at Sport Business has got this great new scoop. And I did think, well, that's good that he's got it first and good for him. But like, it's going to happen anyway. This is news. I just think this is not massively consequential news. What you're doing when you're breaking a story is simply changing the timeline of when a promotional thing is going to be released or not. In the grand scheme of things, I wonder about the journalistic merit of it. But
yes.
No disrespect to John Rest. That's absolutely his brief and absolutely what he should be doing.
None taken, I'm sure.
I guess I'm not a journalist. Am I not cut out for that, Dave? Anyway,
Ferrari.
Give us a bit of background on this then.
So this is Ferrari. They're a Formula One team. They're the most famous Formula One team. And there is a little bit of romance about Ferrari. You would probably bracket them in with something like the All Blacks, maybe even Wimbledon, the Masters. Highly prized.
Ferrari, Yankees, Manchester United, All Blacks.
For sure. And highly prized, highly premium real estate, which is what HP are buying into here. Obviously, the wider story still is Formula One is having its moment. Obviously, I think there's a good discussion to be had about whether sort of F1 has peaked in terms of popularity. But Ferrari are, as always, a central part of the story, even if they're not winning. They've obviously hired Lewis Hamilton at great expense and with great surprise for the 2025 season, for next season. So there's that to factor in as well. But they're very choosy about who they go into business with, who they partner with. And it's very unusual for Ferrari to do a title sponsorship deal. In fact, for a long time, they had no reason to because they had this very long-standing deal with Philip Morris International, with Marlboro, which ran through the tobacco ban on the sponsorship ban on tobacco advertising, but continued as they found various ways to sort of slightly circumnavigate the rules and regulations around tobacco sponsorship and still received significant money from Philip Morris. But this is obviously a technology company. HP are in and in big. So the new name of the team as of this weekend at the Miami Grand Prix, where everything will be fully announced and there's a big media launch planned. Scuderia Ferrari HP, that's the official new name of the team. HP logos everywhere. There's a big tech deployment here, tech rollout. Ferrari will be using a lot of HP equipment and software in time. And there's a lot of various elements to this that I think are particularly interesting. But maybe it's worth us starting, James, by talking through a few of the key people, the people who have made this happen.
So around this negotiation table, all sorts of people, as you'd imagine, and these things take a long time to come to fruition. But Ferrari has gone through a little bit of churn in its commercial team of late. And there are some new players there. Actually, a lot of the key figures in Ferrari's new look commercial team were at AC Milan. There's been a shift of personnel at AC Milan. A lot of them have ended up at Ferrari. But the team around the table for Ferrari, Paul Gandolfi, who's the VP of Biz Dev there. Lorenzo Giorgetti, he is one of these former Milan folks. Former IMG as well. And he was chief. Actually, when I say IMG, I mean RCS. He did the Giro d'Italia. He's the chief racing revenue officer at Ferrari, which I think is a unique job title in Formula One. And then George Pryor and Xavier Valeri Iribarren, also key in building the deal. They're in the sponsorship partnership services department at Ferrari. HP, the team at HP, so led by Antonio Lucio, who is a returning CMO at HP. He's one of these serial CMOs at massive global companies. He had a stint at Meta, and he spent a long time running the marketing at Pepsi.
And he returned in November to HP.
And you've got to think that you don't go back to a job like that unless the conditions are different. And the conditions in this case, I would suggest, are you've got a very significant budget to spend, and we'll go into that later. Elsewhere on the HP side, Stella Lowe played a significant role. She's the Chief Corporate Affairs Officer, and Laure Mbarga Fugit, who's the Global Head of Brand and Partnerships, and Horacio Miranda, who has a job to do with transformation in through marketing. And Ricardo Fort, the former longtime Coca-Cola sponsorship chief, was consulting on the HP side.
It's a big negotiating table, though, because also around it are, as you would imagine, a bunch of really good agency people. And delving into this big old partnership, you can see a lot of Omnicom fingerprints across this deal. So Omnicom owned PhD, the PhD agency is the global media account holder for HP, renewed that deal in January, and we talked about the money that HP is spending on media globally. In 2023, HP spent $194 million, and PhD retained that work following a three-month review, as is the nature of the advertising industry. It's been the global agency of HP since 2017, so it was the incumbent. And a few of the key names here: Liz Donaldson, the Chief Agency Development Officer; Toby Hack, who is the CEO at PhD in the EMEA region; and then Guy Marks, who's the CEO worldwide at PhD.
I think Toby Hack's any relation to Rufus Hack at Hawkeye.
Don't know. Good question. We can probably find
do
out.
Write in. Do write in.
And what appears to have happened is PhD have brought HP to the table, and the table belonging to Fuse Ignite, another Omnicom-owned company. So Fuse Ignite is the rights and consulting arm of the Fuse agency, well-known sports marketing agency, very well-known in the industry. But Fuse Ignite was formed back in 2021 to work specifically on rights and consulting. And this is the first really big public bit of business that organization has done. So you've got Chief Strategy Officer at Fuse, Alex Charkham, who was involved in this. John Nasp is the head of Fuse Ignite. And then you've got Rohan Poppet, the Senior Director of Commercial Strategy at Fuse, who was a key part of bringing all this together. So you can see how sort of inside the Omnicom world, this has sort of all been strategized and thought through. And Fuse able to bring Ferrari into play, HP coming from PhD, and the germ of the deal was there.
It's amazing how typical this is of major sports sponsorship deals now, in terms of the two sides of the negotiation table being brought together really within one agency group.
And it's what agencies at that level,
it's what they're
sort of multi-agency
in.
Approach is specializing in actually promoting its offering as, you know, the ability to work cross-agency, to bring new services, new provisions to whether it's brands or rights holders. And so it's doing exactly what Omnicom wants its agency businesses to do.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about the value exchange here, David. You mentioned that obviously Ferrari's going to use HP stuff. We're going to get HP on the cars, in the name. What's Ferrari getting? What's HP getting out of this?
Well, from a monetary point of view, there's obviously some speculation. There have been reports that the value of this deal could be worth as much as $300 million over 5 years, which would be comparable to the other biggest title sponsorship in F1, which is Oracle's deal with world champions Red Bull Racing. In reality, extremely hard, and I think actually it would be very few people, even probably amongst those that we mentioned, who would have a single number to point to on a deal like this because of that tech rollout. And, you know, what value to HP do you attribute to, you know, the tech showcase that being seen to be powering Ferrari's F1 team provides? So 300 million sounds about right over 5 years, certainly at the higher end of Formula One title sponsorships.
It'll be the biggest, and you'll know this, David, HP are no strangers. It's interesting how this sort of thing comes about. HP obviously got a returning marketing chief, but he himself and his predecessors will be no stranger to Formula. It's interesting that it's cooked up within an agency, because HP are a long-term backer of various Formula One entities. They've been in various guises sponsors of numerous different teams in the past. They were Williams's main backer for some time. They've been involved with
2003 to 2005. So that would have been, for those who remember, the BMW Williams era, blue and white cars, very HP. Juan Pablo Montoya, Ralph Schumacher era. Great era, actually.
They've also had involvement with Mercedes and Stake F1, and when it was sat with Sauber.
Yeah, currently suppliers, actually. Yeah. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, which is, they're listed as a supplier. They're not I would imagine, providing cash input to the team, but they are supplying services, essential services. Be interesting to see whether those deals continue.
So this is basically, this is a, I mean, it's less of a strategy, more of an addiction, as some wag put it on the internet, in terms of HP's continued coming back to Formula One. Clearly they see a lot of value in presence in the paddock.
Absolutely, and they will be joining a number of teams who currently have title partners. In fact, by my reckoning, we've only now got McLaren and Williams, who are the only teams without a designated title partner. There's a lot of rumour, incidentally, about MasterCard. This was another Sport Business report. Up to four F1 teams are chasing MasterCard hard for potential title sponsorship. We've obviously seen Visa come in over the winter in a slightly odd half-and-half title sponsorship deal with a Cash App to sponsor the second Red Bull team. Kick, as you mentioned, betting platform in as Sauber's title sponsor. The aforementioned Aramco sponsoring Aston Martin. BWT, the Water People, are the title sponsor of the Renault-owned Alpine team. Petronas, long-term title sponsor of Mercedes. And then MoneyGram are a sponsor of the grid's smallest team, Haas. It's also worth thinking about HP's global sponsorship portfolio, and it's worth noting the very big deal that they did only back in February. Again, interesting timing if you think the new CMO got his feet back under the desk in November. By February, they were announcing a major partnership, a multi-year partnership with Real Madrid, and we talk about premium rights holders with a certain sort of cachet. Shirt sleeve partners, major tech installation partners at the Bernabeu, the newly renovated Bernabeu Stadium, a real digital transformation project. So again, this combination of branding, clearly, the ability to showcase tech, but also the alignment with a really premium, world-class, world-recognized sports organization that is pretty discerning about the partnerships it takes on.
Antonio Lucio's back and he's got bunts in his pocket, that's for sure. I'd say one of the kickers of this deal, David, is in the branding and the merchandise. Any deal, I mean, I can't remember the last time Ferrari will have included a prominent partner on the merchandise it makes. And as we all know, Ferrari sells more caps than cars.
It would have been Marlboro.
It would have been Marlboro back in the day, but you know,
since then
it's just been a red Ferrari hat.
That's it.
That red Ferrari hat's now got a big HP on it, and I think what that's worth to HP, I don't know, but they will put a figure on it. There's going to be a lot of HP logos on a lot of merch.
Indeed, that's the sort of medium, longer term play here. In the very short term, this weekend at the Miami Grand Prix, mentioned there's going to be a media launch. This partnership will come to life, in a revised Ferrari livery. And all the suggestion is, and perhaps you'll have seen this by the time you're hearing this, but we haven't as yet, but the suggestion is that the Ferrari is going to be at least in part turned blue for the race this weekend, obviously playing a little bit on the sort of style of Miami, the vibe of Miami as well. So it probably works from that point of view, but that's a nod to HP and the level of investment, because you don't get to come in and help change the colour of a Ferrari F1 car very often. So that will be, both CEOs will be in attendance in Miami this weekend. Benedetto Vigna, the CEO of Ferrari, along with Enrique Lores, the CEO of HP. And we're expecting a blue-ish Ferrari this weekend on the grid.
It's worth saying, I think, Formula One offers some of the best B2B sponsorship activation opportunities because of the plethora and allure of the hospitality opportunities involved there. I mean, it's no secret and it is an obvious thing, but I think Formula One very much coming back into vogue through Drive to Survive, etc. Huge emphasis on going big and going often in America as a B2B sponsorship proposition it's just gone up a couple of notches in the last couple of years. And I think we're seeing that by the type of companies that are coming in at this level.
And we mentioned him earlier, Lewis Hamilton is joining Ferrari in 2025. So effectively what HP is doing here is probably the cheapest possible way, even though there'll be an enormous amount of money going into this, as we've talked about. But it's probably the cheapest possible way to get a slice of Lewis Hamilton. You partner the team that he's about to join, and you make the link between a bunch of Ferrari caps and Ferrari merchandise with HP logos on it. If Lewis Hamilton, as well as Charles Leclerc, another sort of superstar driver, although not at Lewis Hamilton's level of global fame outside of Formula One, but you put all that together, and that's a really potent combination, because it's going to be quite hard to miss HP's logo in any sort of F1 environment for quite some time.
Do you think we're going to see the HP CEO's son maybe replacing Charles Leclerc in the second seat at Ferrari?
Perhaps for a practice session.
Maybe.
Here or there.
Thanks for taking us inside the deal, David.
No problem. You're welcome.
Anything else float your boat in the 182nd section, David? Can you remember it?
Well, I think the prospect of Amazon coming in as a major partner of the NBA is one that we need to watch. Framework agreement reportedly in place here for a big old package of rights, I think bigger than a lot of people perhaps suspected. This is the NBA sort of constructing almost the next decade of its rights in the US and beyond, actually, because there's some talk that the Amazon agreement, if it is actually signed, will include a number of global rights, which we've talked about previously on podcasts recently, sort of market by market versus global approach. Be pretty powerful, I think, for an organization like Amazon, a platform like Prime Video, to take global NBA rights or even global rights in a number of significant markets.
And actually, there is a lesson here, I think, for sports rights holders, sports properties that control more than one property, more than one league, more than one competition, in how you can use your secondary competitions and experimentation in how you slice and dice the rights here for the benefit of the whole, because Amazon is a long-term partner of the WNBA, recently extended its package of rights with the W, and clearly the lessons, the learnings, the relationships have been sort of taken into a larger deal for the larger league in the NBA. And it did get me thinking, does the Premier League over here in the UK miss a trick by not being involved in the discussion over who runs the WSL, for example?
Maybe
that's one for another time. I was interested in this DAZN news. DAZN apparently taking the German Football League to court over the league's decision to award rights to Sky, despite the fact that DAZN's bid was, in their view, higher.
And they met the reservation price. It's worth saying that we're recording this on Tuesday morning, because I suspect this is one of those stories that is relatively fast moving.
Yeah, I'm sure that will move along, yeah. It caught my eye mainly because DAZN's been very busy recently with a few bold moves. I saw that they'd... they'd also done a fairly significant partnership with OnlyFans, David. Mm. Is it the user-generated content subscription site?
The niche platform?
I don't think there's anything niche.
No. Tell me more about this deal.
Well, so this is not the first time that OnlyFans has got into sport. They signed a deal with Nick Kyrgios not too long ago, and they actually have a division that is focused on sports and entertainment in terms of attracting content creators and therefore fans to that platform. And clearly now they are branching out into more substantial agreements with sports properties / broadcasters. So this is ostensibly an advertising deal with DAZN, but it gets into DAZN's boxing events. So there were OnlyFans logos on the I'm not sure if they were on the, what do you call it? What's it called?
The mat? Canvas.
The canvas.
I'm not, mat.
What is it called?
The
in
canvas.
The ring. I'm just, in my head, I've got tatami. But it's because I'm a sumo guy.
No, I know you're a sumo guy.
When
are we going inside the sumo deal?
Oh, very soon, David. Yeah, very good. Soon. Anyway, there were OnlyFans logos at the Haney Garcia fight this weekend. And apparently, DAZN has over 200 combat sports athletes with accounts. They have launched accounts on OnlyFans in the last 2 years. Now, I don't know whether these are as content creators or as content consumers. And I'm not sure that OnlyFans should be putting out that information if it's the latter. But it's an interesting branch out from OnlyFans, a recognition perhaps that people that are using that site have other interests. You know, they can serve them with different things and they can attract them from different places.
And I'm just reading through the notes that you sent me on this, James, and I'm struck by the line, I'm struck by the question that DAZN presumably is asking itself, what sort of content can you expect to see from DAZN? And the answer has been provided by DAZN, but they use this phrase, OnlyFans will be DAZN's dedicated online fan club. And I think that's interesting. Especially if they've got 200 athletes already creating content on there. But this sort of, it all comes back to this idea of online communities and serving people, super serving, I suppose, more hardcore fans who want that extra stuff. And there's also something here
around...
You
could use the word hardcore there, David.
Yes, yeah, deliberately. There is also something, I think, about this sort of consistent need for hardcore fans to see more behind the scenes stuff, and I think if this can provide that, it could be quite an effective tool for DAZN in terms of not only marketing what it's got coming up, but providing a greater level of engagement, especially as it's also delving in, myriad of DAZN announcements in recent times, but it continues to sort of work at the betting market and looking at gamification and really sort of actively, it certainly seems from the outset, really actively testing and learning. We obviously had Tom Waterhouse on a couple of weeks ago from a rights strategy perspective, but all the bits beyond that, the shoulder stuff, is really interesting. And so, yeah, I think this is one to watch to see what impact it has and whether we ever get to hear about that impact.
Mm-hmm. A few movers and shakers this week that caught my eye. Joel Seymour Hyde is the new head of partnership management at Formula One. Andre Villas-Boas, you remember him as a Chelsea manager. He's the new president of Porto, the football club.
He's a very nice chap, Andre Villas-Boas. I watched the Monaco Grand Prix with Andre
Did
Villas-Boas.
Did you really?
In Monaco,
yeah.
1 year, and okay. He's an absolutely lovely guy.
Charming. Would you count him as a friend?
No, I wouldn't. Yeah. He wasn't quite cut out for football management, as it turned out.
Have you seen that clip of John Terry doing the rounds? John Terry on a podcast recounting the tale of Andre Villas-Boas trying to make his mark at Chelsea when he came in as the manager there and wanted to operate a kind of flat structure. There's no hierarchies here. And there was, the seats on a plane on a pre-season tour to Hong Kong had been randomly allocated across the squad. It meant that John Terry was sitting in economy and some youth players were sitting up front. And Terry lost his rag with that. Had a hissy fit, refused to go on the trip unless Villas-Boas did something about this. And of course, Villas-Boas did do something about that.
Villas-Boas is also, once his sort of management career ended, he went rallying at one point, didn't he?
Did he do the Dakar rally?
I can't remember. Yeah, it was one of the sort of major rally raids. But now he's hopefully found his his new calling, but he's won election. He's won an election to do this, and he's in there at FC Porto. Yeah.
And Sue Day is the new director of women's football at the FA. She's joining from the RFU. Do you have any recommendations this week, David?
Yes, I do, actually. In typical fashion, it's a podcast. It's actually, and I find this genuinely hard to fathom, it's 30 years ago this week since Ayrton Senna was killed at the San Marino Grand Prix in 1994. One of the most sort of catastrophic, shocking weekends in Formula One history, actually probably in the history of sport. Roland Ratzenberger was also killed on the same weekend. And you know, James, F1's my sport, and I've been listening to a super new podcast, which is actually doing three special episodes on the sort of horrors of that weekend and the build-up to it and the aftermath of it, with Richard Williams, the fine, the doyen of sports writers, Guardian writer.
I love that Richard Williams does motorsport and jazz.
That's, yeah, it's, what amazing. A combination. Yeah. What a combination. Richard Williams and Matt Bishop, former journalist, Formula One journalist, and for a long time the chief communications officer at McLaren and then at Aston Martin F1 teams. It's an excellent podcast where it's called And Colossally That's History, which is a reference to a commentary line from Murray Walker. But it's a fantastic podcast which takes various parts of motorsport history and sort of reappraises them. So it's right in my sweet spot, and they've done a really fabulous, at least the first part of this three-part series on those terrible events 30 years ago, which I would thoroughly recommend, almost as much for the impact, the aftermath, and, you know, genuinely, I think one of the big turning points in the history of Formula One in terms of the changes that came after that in terms of the way that the sport was broadcast, and particularly bad accidents were broadcast, the safety features on the cars, but also the TV ratings went up after that, and effectively was the sort of precursor to Bernie Ecclestone, who was then in charge, being able to start a seemingly endless process of selling off bits of the business, which didn't end too well for him.
It's such a weird thing, isn't it? The sports like Formula One need to be both dangerous and potentially fatally dangerous, but also completely safe. They need to market the danger, but also ensure that nobody dies.
Absolutely. In 1994, when Senna was killed and Ratzenberger the day before him, it had been 12 years since a driver had been killed.
Everyone assumed it was safe.
And there was a sense of complacency. And then there was a long period until 2014 when Jules Bianchi had a terrible accident at the Japanese Grand Prix, actually died several months later. That was now 10 years ago. But you're absolutely right. And something like, do you remember the huge accident that Romain Grosjean had at the Bahrain Grand Prix, where the car effectively exploded, went through the barrier, the miracle escape? You'll have seen it on Drive to Survive if you weren't watching it live. Obviously a shocking moment, genuinely shocking moment, but he came out of that pretty much unscathed, and therefore it's a fulsome part of the way that F1 is promoted. So you're exactly right, but I think it's interesting to sort of reflect on how sort of attitudes to danger and death and safety in motorsport have changed over those 30 years.
Of course, it's worth saying at this point that if you haven't seen Senna, the Asif Kapadia film, you must correct that. There's probably no better time than now, given the anniversary. A phenomenal film that probably sparked off this kind of wave of sports documentaries, is emotive, very powerful, original filmmaking,
drawing on so much archive
footage. Kapadia's kind of specialism is in piecing together all of this old footage and setting it to music, really.
What have you got?
Your recommendation from me, also a podcast. So I've not listened to this before. It was The Deal with Alex Rodriguez. It's a Bloomberg podcast about sports business, I guess.
Hang on. is this where you got the inspiration for our new feature?
Quite possibly, yeah. So this is the deal. So the guest this week was Mark Shapiro, the president of TKO, the WWE and UFC entity. I think also the president of Endeavor. One of the chief beneficiaries of the move to privatise Endeavour, and a fantastically compelling executive, a producer, really. He's come up through, he's sort of telling his life and career story. He tells a very amusing tale of how he met Ari Emanuel, who has obviously been a partner of his at Endeavor through thick and thin, since an amusing plane journey when Shapiro was working for Disney, I think it was.
It's amazing how these people often have sort of life and career defining conversations on planes. I don't think I've ever had a
life-changing
conversation on a plane.
You don't sit up front, do you?
No, that's true.
I think that's the key. That's the key thing. Also interesting to hear Alex Rodriguez on that podcast. I've not heard A-Rod.
Why doesn't he call it A-Pod?
He's missed a trick. Or maybe that's next.
Yeah.
He's missed a trick there. Alex Rodriguez interjects every now and again with kind of almost sort of semi-motivational business maxims. Things like, let's hustle. What else does he say?
You told me he sort of just shouts out quite obscure, presumably baseball references.
Yeah, he'll say things like, I call him a 5'2 guy, which means he can do everything in business.
Yes.
Anyway, entertaining on a number of counts, so indeed, do check that out, The Deal.
Should we just break some news about Mark Shapiro whilst we're here?
Are we allowed to?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Yeah, Shapiro is going to be one of the headliners on the headline stage for Leaders Week in October. We are launching it a little later this week. It's going to be big.
It's going to be absolutely huge. October the 16th and 17th at Twickenham, part of a week of events, the usual Leaders Week stuff and some. It's going to be absolutely terrific. And yes, delighted, Mark Shapiro is going to be one of several extremely big names on that programme.
No podcast from us. Next week, we have got Barbara Slater with us for Leaders in Focus, our snazzy interview show. But we will see each other and you again the following week. So stay safe and have fun.